Greetings yet again to each and all, those who still care and dare to listen, and a wicked welcome to Mythophrenia, where you find talks and texts by Gnostic teacher John Lamlash on a range of topics relevant to the Terma of Gaia awakening, the Sophianic view of life, Planetary Tantra, and the Calico War Party. I'm recording in the early hours of the morning of February 19th, 2017. There is a last quarter moon in the sky, noting the completion of the Matangi shift. This is the second installment in the series called Gnostic Sallies, and the title is Immortality and the Mirror World. As I've noted before, I'm reserving the talks in this category of Gnostic Sallies for some deliveries in the first person, and I'm using it indulgently, you could say, in order to get some things off my chest and clear my mind at moments when I'm feeling a bit cluttered or perhaps disturbed and perturbed by something, as I am right now. Unfortunately, and it is a great unfortune indeed, I don't have any of you present here with me, right in front of me, present in flesh and blood, as they say, so that I could bounce my comments off you, and you could respond, and you could challenge me, you could pose questions, and who knows, we might even be able to have a few laughs along the way. Well, here I am, coming into the home stretch of my career of teaching, and I still find myself, most of the time, doing a monologue on the internet. So, I shall make do and make the best of what I have. Before I start, I would have you direct your attention to the text that goes along with this talk, which you can find under Gnostic Sallies, under Mythophrenia, on metahistory.org. And you will see that I've indicated there three reference items that accompany this talk. One of them is an entry in Wikipedia, a definition of the term POIMANDRES. The second is a link to a YouTube clip concerning recent comments made by an AI guru, AI IT guru, by the name of Elon Musk. Elon, E-L-O-N. Musk. And the third is what I have in my very hands, that is to say, volume one of the four volumes of the Hermetica, translated by Walter Scott and published by Shambhala. These four volumes have the Corpus Hermeticum, or the works of the body, that body of literature known as the Hermetica for short. And in the Walter Scott translation, you find the Greek and Latin, the Greek or Latin text, as it may be, on the left-hand page, and the English translation on the right-hand page. So I have volume one open, which I bought in Studio City at Dutton's bookstore a good many years ago. I have volume one here, open at page 113, which is the first book of the Corpus Hermeticum. And it opens like this. Once on a time, when I had begun to think about the things that are, and my thoughts had soared high aloft, while my bodily senses had been put under restraint by sleep, Yet not such sleep as that of men weighed down by fullness of food or by bodily weariness. Methought there came to me a being of vast and boundless magnitude, who called me by my name and said to me, "What do you wish to hear and see, and to learn and come to know by thought?" "Who are you?" I said. "I," said he, "am Poimandres, the mind of the sovereignty." "I would fain learn," said I, "the things that are, and understand their nature, and get the knowledge of God." "These," I said, "are the things of which I wish to hear." He answered, "I know what you wish, for indeed I am with you everywhere. Keep in mind all that you desire to learn, and I will teach you." End quote. First paragraph of Book 1 of the Hermetica. That translation would have been done sometime, probably in the early part of the 20th century. Walter Scott, who should not be confused with Sir Walter Scott, was an English scholar and professor who made these translations in the last years of his life, and he lived from 1855 to 1925. Now, if you are so inclined, I would have you click on the Wikipedia entry I linked and follow three other translations listed there. The first is by John Everard. "Then said I, 'Who art thou?' 'I am,' quoth he, 'Poimander, the mind of the great Lord, the most mighty and absolute emperor. I know what you wouldest have, and I am always present with thee.'" End quote. Next is G.R.S. Meade, who was a Gnostic scholar. I quote him often in Not in His Image. "And I do say, 'Who art thou?' He saith, 'I am man-shepherd, mind of all masterhood. I know what thou desirest, and I'm with thee everywhere.'" End quote. Finally, a translation by Salomon Van Oyen and Wharton, whoever they might be. "Who are you?" said I. He said, "I am Poimandres, the noose of the supreme. I know what you wish, and I am with you everywhere." So there you go, four translations so far, and a fifth one in the making. Now, speaking in the first person as a self-taught scholar, I'm going to take the liberty to give you a little piece of advice. If you bought a basic grammar, Greek grammar, and a Greek-English dictionary, or availed yourself of an online Greek-English dictionary, and you sat down with this Shambhala edition of the Hermetica, you could work through the Greek quite easily. You don't have to know how to read Greek. You don't have to know all the points of grammar, perhaps some very essential points, simply to recognize a verb, to recognize a noun, to recognize a pronouns and words such as with and by and to. Simple things like that. By looking at alternate translations and then looking closely at the Greek lines that have been translated, well, you don't have to be an expert of ancient Greek texts to work out the game. It's just not that difficult. It's just words in a language, a fairly elementary language. So you might be wondering, since I'm standing here with a book in hand, looking at the original Greek, or looking at a typographic simulation of the original Greek, you might wonder what they're all talking about when this entity introduces itself. How come these translations are so different? They're all working out of the same basic Greek language, in the original text. And what is that language? Well, ego men physin aimi o poimandros otes authenticas nous. Now, I can't pronounce Greek, but that's exactly what it is. And I'll write down the transcription for you. You look for the transcription included with the notes in this text. The transcription means to render the Greek letters into English letters. So, for instance, the Greek letters epsilon, gamma, omega are E-G-O, meaning I, ego. So you can see the transcription into English lettering of the original Greek. And you can see that the translators are embellishing considerably upon the original text. They are building something in the text into something that is really not in the text. The key words, when this great presence of intelligence addresses the sleeper, the key words in which it identifies itself are two words, authentias nous. How would I translate that? I would translate it as authentic mind or original mind, and let go of all the other fancy talk. So I'm using this passage from the Hermetica to introduce the subject of immortality, which relates very closely to this notion of the authentic or original mind. Now, I'm sure there are people out there, some would be scholars and others would not be scholars, who would dismiss me entirely as not having the competence or qualifications to make any translation whatsoever. And I, in turn, would raise this objection. I, in turn, would sally in this way. Well, you might accuse me of some irresponsible meddling as a self-taught scholar who doesn't even know how to read Greek. Some irresponsible meddling with a profound and indeed sacred passage in the Hermetica. But for my part, I would ask you if you have any experience of what is being described in this text. Have you yourself had an encounter with the authentios nous, similar to the one described in this opening paragraph? And if you yourself have not directly and experientially encountered authentias nous, then what basis do you have for making a translation of any kind? See my point? I've raised the same objection, if you want to call it that. I've raised the same point in regarding the translation of the Nag Hammadi codexes. Haven't I? Yes, I have. Because there you have a glaring example of quite a considerable body of work derived from mystical initiation in ancient schools of esotericism. And the scholars translating that material today, as far as I know, have never had the experiences from which the Nag Hammadi material derives. They have not undergone translearning, mystical states, paranormal access to the matrix of superintelligence in the cosmos. They have not gone there, been there, done that. And consequently, how can you expect them to present an adequate and accurate translation of these materials? So that's my beef, that's my grief, you know. But that's why I come here on Gnostic Sallies, right? I come here to bitch and complain, right? Cranky old Turton in his last days. He had to get this stuff off his mind. And he's just using you to do so. Fair enough. At least you know what you're in for. Now let's take just a couple of minutes to review this opening paragraph. Notice how it states a couple of attributes, striking attributes, of the being of vast and boundless magnitude that reveals itself here to a human witness who may be asleep or may be in a state of semi-sleep, perhaps in that state between sleeping and waking, which is prone to produce what are called hypnagogic hallucinations. So, note the attributes of this being. They're clearly stated by the being itself. It says, first, I know what you want to hear. And second, it says, I am with you everywhere. All right, stop and consider that for a moment. Consider a being of vast magnitude, an intelligence of the cosmos, nous being the word for mind or intelligence, that has the capacity to reach an individual human mind, a human witness. It reveals its vastness to the human witness. It talks in the speech of the mind to the mind of the witness. And it says, I know exactly what you want to know, what you want to learn, and I am with you everywhere. Now, put yourself in the place of the witness in the opening passage of Book 1 of the Hermetica. Would you like to be in that position? Would you like to be privileged to such an encounter? Perhaps you have been privileged to such an encounter. I have a feeling that some of you listening to these words, whether it be now in the time that I'm here to record them or in the time to come, I have a feeling that some of you would jump up eagerly and say, oh yeah, right, I have had that experience. You're confirming something that happened to me. I also am a first-hand witness to the mystical wonders described in this passage. The mystical encounter with supermind, with the original mind of the universe, Authentius Nous. And I would say, well, that's fine, and I'm quite happy for you, but I would like to know what you got out of it. I would like to know what you retained from it. And I would like to know, most of all, if you really did encounter original mind that spoke to your individual mind from a dimension of cosmic awareness, then what residue of originality did it leave in your mind? And what can you say about that encounter that is truly novel and original? That's what I would ask you. Because it's one thing to claim that you would have had such an experience. And believe me, I wish you well, and I wish it to anyone. Well, not anyone, but I wish it to people of good heart and intention. But you have to prove it, you see. It has to be proven. Just as it's proven here by the content of the first book of the Corpus Hermeticum. What is it? What is found in that book, in that text? Well, it's an account that someone gave coming from their encounter with authentic mind. And of course it is transcribed, as often occurs, as if it were a channeling type of New Age experience. I would also point out that somewhere or other in planetary tantra, I did make rather a point of indicating that Dakini instruction is not channeling. And in order to draw the distinction between Dakini instruction, which would be transception of authentic mind into the individual human mind, in distinguishing that experience from channeling, I said specifically that the instructing power, the Dakini or Devata, producing that instruction in your mind, never announces itself to you. But you'll see here in the opening paragraph that Authentias Nous announces itself and even declares its name to the witness. So I would say, by modern standards of planetary tantra, this passage fails the truth test. It really is just an example of a channeling. But nevertheless, there may be some elements of transception of cosmic intelligence within it. Now you have to go and you have to examine the contents and evaluate the contents for what they're worth. And on the basis of the contents and the way they're stated, you have the proof of the authenticity of the encounter with cosmic mind. You follow me so far? Just started to rain at dawn here in Spain. So, you know, if we were in a academic situation together, an academic setting, let's say in a lecture hall, an auditorium, and there I am on the stage, the prof, and there you are, students, in the audience. We could spend a day or several days tearing through book one of the Corpus Hermeticum. That would be like throwing Deputy Dog a bone. Yeah, you would see Deputy Dog. That's one of my IT avatars, by the way. Gnawing away at that bone, gobbling up that bone, and I guarantee you there wouldn't be much left of the Corpus Hermeticum after Deputy Dog had his chew. But I'm not going to chew that bone for you right now. Rather, I'm going to go directly to the chase. Directly to the fuck, as they say. Cut to the fuck. And by that I mean, I'm going to tell you about the wisdom goddess sitting on your face, which is my term for encountering Authentias Nous. It's my turn of phrase, one of my turns of phrase. How do I dare to meddle around with ancient manuscripts like this in Greek, Latin, and Coptic, Egyptian, who knows what? I do it on the basis of one assumption that I make. Since I'm entirely transparent about my method, I shall tell you my assumption. But before I do, I wonder if you can hear the sound of the rain. Just let me point out that it started to rain a few seconds before I referred to the wisdom goddess sitting on your face, didn't it? So something made it get wet out there before I even said those words. But if she is with me everywhere, and if she knows what I want to learn, and oh boy, does she know what I want to learn and what I want to teach, well, it's not surprising that it started to rain at that moment, is it? That's what you call interactive magic with Gaia. So, to my assumption, I assume that I have had those experiences of direct encounter with Authentias Nous, and therefore I can speak with more authority than expert scholars who have never gotten anywhere near those moments of cognitive ecstasy in the presence of the wisdom goddess, and who probably do not even allow that any such experiences would be possible or valid. So I base my authority, if you will, on my experience. What the fuck else can I base it on? And the sovereignty of my experience is just exactly like the sovereignty of yours. However, I would add, and I'll be as kind as possible in doing so, that the authenticity that comes from contact with the authentic mind of the cosmos has to build. It builds. If it doesn't build, it may well still be authentic, but it doesn't have the emergent force within it that can actually bring to expression the full flowering of that sublime encounter. Am I making any sense? As far as I know, it is possible for an encounter with authentic mind, such as described in this passage, to happen spontaneously. There are spontaneous hits, no doubt about that. They happen to people in their childhood. They happen at critical moments in their lives. But merely having a hit of authentic mind is not like having a take. And what is the proof that you have a take? What is the proof that it takes in your mind? Well, the proof is in the takeaway, you see? So I claim to have had that experience, which is adumbrated in the opening passage of Book 1 of the Hermetica. And I would report that I have had it in a number of ways. Initially, I had it at a very early age, in childhood, and then through my teens. In dramatic and baffling experiences, which I could not comprehend at the time. Those were unforgettable experiences, but I can't really say that I could articulate the takeaway. They were hits, but were they takes? Another characteristic of the take is that it is deliberate. You can go back for more. So it is sort of like ordering out from the wisdom goddess. Well, she can come to where you are and deliver her erotic services lavishly, but you can also go to her place and you can order out. And what you get is a takeaway, but you also get the customer privilege card. That is to say, you return to the place where you receive her bounty of wisdom deliberately. When you can return there deliberately, knowing where you're going and what you're going for, then the authenticity conferred in you by encounter with the authentic mind of the cosmos builds. And this is how it works. So I would say before summer of 2002, I had undergone maybe half a dozen hits in my life, maybe eight. But from that time onward, let's see, 2002, coming ahead 15 years, making an average of six, modestly, an average of six times a year. That's 90 encounters, you say. 90 deliberate encounters with specific takeaway each time. And that's not including the moments of Dakini instruction that come up in the course of the lunar cycle, the observation of the lunar Shaktis. That's not even including that. I'm just talking about somewhere in the area of 90 telestic encounters with the planetary logos. Now, I'm springing that term on you, okay? Maybe it had already crossed your mind. Most scholars and most other self-taught individuals, ladies and gentlemen like myself, who would care to come forward today and put themselves out as interpreters of the esoteric and the arcane and the mystical, would say that the first book of the Corpus Semiticum describes an encounter with the planetary logos. Planetary logos is a euphemism for the goddess Sophia. It is a euphemism for the authentias nous of the earth itself, the super intelligence of the super organism that is this planet. Planetary logos. And you'll find that there's a book in the Nakamadi, which one is it? I can't remember. Which uses the term planetary logos and logos by way of referring to Sophia, but does not refer to her directly as an animal entity, as a living, female, divine, galactic scale goddess. There's a tendency that you find in Plato and Neoplatonic writings, in which the Corpus Semiticum may be included, and various other male mind philosophers, to play down the presence of the planetary animal mother as such. To those esteemed individuals, her presence as an animal, her presence as an aroused female animal, is something that they don't care to consider. And so they put a filter on the authentias nous, such as they perceive it, and they give it the male mind designation of the planetary logos. So the mind of the sovereign, or the mind of the sovereignty, as Walter Scott puts it, is nothing other than the planetary logos, the mind of the planet itself, but described in a manner that is stripped of its sensuous and feminine erotic properties and qualities. Now, having gotten that out of my system, and it stopped raining 30 seconds ago, let's do a little segue to the YouTube clip that I have linked, which is a commentary by some individual on comments made by this AI guru and mastermind of informational technology known as Elon Musk. I would point out, by the way, that Elon Musk is Jewish. By self-identity, I'm not calling him Jewish. I'm not pointing the finger and saying, Elon Musk is a Jew. Elon Musk himself wears the identity of being a Jew. So do a number of the leading masterminds of AI, IT, and quantum computing, so-called, such as David Deutsch, who's a key figure at CERN. So there you have it. Just pay attention to where your information is coming from. Pay attention to who's feeding you the narrative. And what is the narrative described in this clip? Well, listen to it. It speaks for itself. The narrative that's being pushed by people like Elon Musk is that the takeover of human labor by AI is inevitable. Soon there will be driverless cars. It's inevitable. It's going to happen whether you like it or not. It's going to happen no matter if you want it to happen or not. Well, first of all, that is a lie. It is not going to happen simply because Elon Musk says it's going to happen. Who is he? God? Oh, well, maybe he's a close kin to George Soros, because George Soros, who's also a Jew, recently admitted that he considers himself to be God and to function as a God on this planet. So maybe talking from the same Jewish God complex. Now there's a subject for you to chew on. Talking from the Jewish God complex, Elon Musk feels confident in telling us what's coming. And of course, who hasn't heard this line for years now? The technology is improving so rapidly. The technology is advancing so rapidly that soon IT devices and AI is going to replace all human activity. And there's the possibility that these intelligent machines may become smarter than we are. So then you have, of course, the common science fiction theme of the revolt of the robots and the revolt of the machines, who eventually become more intelligent than their creators and turn on their creators and wipe them out. This is a science fiction fantasy that propagates itself on the level of a very powerful myth in the human psyche, and a large number of people on this planet today are living out this science fiction narrative. Now, why am I bringing this up, and how does it relate to this topic of authentic mind? Well, recently, somewhere, where was it? Oh, yeah. In one of the Mandela Effect Decoded talks, Invitation to Mythophrenia, I made the outrageous statement, and of course it's not outrageous at all, it's just common sense, that humanity at large is plunging now into a schizophrenic state. The whole entire human race is going into a schizophrenic blitz. A schiz blitz. That's what I call it. And when I heard this commentary on this talk by Musk, it confirmed that observation for me. Look at what Musk is saying. On the one hand, he's a champion of AI. He's obviously it's a big business opportunity for him, right? Because there's a lot of money in it. Fuck knows what the profits in it are. How can you put billions of dollars into this stuff? I mean, I don't follow the money, but there is a lot of money involved. There's a lot of money involved in creating, apparently, in creating a D-Wave quantum computer. It costs somewhat billions of dollars. And what does it do? It can't make a donkey fart. It can't boil an egg. But there it is, costing billions of dollars. But maybe that's a hoax. Maybe a D-Wave quantum computer is exactly what it looks like. A big black metal box with nothing inside. And it's all a big hoax. Anyway, back to my point. What is Elon Musk and others of his ilk saying about AI? Well, they're talking in a schizophrenic manner. They're talking in doublethink. Their minds are disintegrating into two warring components, two opposing and contradictory voices in their minds. With one voice, he's saying AI is inevitable. It's going to replace drivers, so we're going to have to find some other jobs for these cab drivers and these truck drivers. And it's going to be so convenient. This is the word he uses. The convenience is going to be out of this world. Stunning. Doesn't say if these developments are for the betterment of the human race in any way. Will the quality of life be better if I call a cab that has no driver to take me to the airport? Will my ride to the airport be better? Will, you know, it doesn't consider any of these questions. But he is obviously in favor of pursuing AI to the point of replacing humans with machines. But then another part of his mind is saying, spooky stuff. Gee, it's possible there's something called the dark blah, 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 imahu. Did you hear about that before? That's the African word for the deepest part of the internet, which is like the deepest part of the jungles of Burundi. Okay? And out there, in those deep jungles of AI, artificial intelligence, is the threat that it will take us over. So on the one hand, and destroy us. So on the one hand, here is an individual pleading to bring in this technology, and at the same time, and even pleading for a hybridization or a unification of the digital self of each person. Imagine that. What is your digital self? The unifying the digital self of each person with advanced programs of AI operating out of quantum computing mainframes, and that's where it's all going. Oh, but wait, that's scary, and maybe we shouldn't go there, but maybe we should, but maybe we must, but we don't have any choice. It's quite clear that this individual, Elon Musk, is in a state of doublethink in his own mind. He's on the verge of a schizophrenic breakdown, if he is not already there, you see? And he's just an example of, a good example of the leading people in that field. There's a talk going around by the leading engineer and entrepreneur who produces these D-Wave computers, which is the big fantasy of our time. It's sort of like the modern-day version of a Flash Gordon zap gun. That's a D-Wave quantum computer, right? Has never been proven to do anything. And this individual, his name is Rose. Can't remember his first name. I'll find the link. First of all, says that these computers, of which he is the sole agent and salesman, can solve so many problems. But he doesn't give an example of any single problem. And I defy any of you to find any instance of any problem that has ever been solved by quantum computing. There is no instance, to my knowledge. So again, the schizophrenia reveals itself in this hyperbole, the mindset that is preaching the religion of AI and IT without delivering any of the miracles that it's supposed to deliver. And at the same time, in some cases, they are exhibiting an all-too-human fear of what this artificial intelligence will do if it's given too much slack. And interestingly, the father of quantum computing opens up his talk by giving a sweet little incident of a conversation with his son And it's so glaringly obvious that his son wants a live pet, and his father can't even conceive what a live pet is. You have to hear him repeat this anecdote to realize how absurd it is. But it shows you that the human race is going into a schizophrenic breakdown. To put it more precisely, how about this? These scientists, these masterminds, deeply involved with IT, AI, and quantum computing, are in a state of cognitive dissonance, which is the first stage of the disintegration of their mental faculties, leading to full-blown schizophrenia. They are in cognitive dissonance because the theories that they maintain regarding AI are insane and absurd and have no realistic or reasonable outcome. They are stating assertions, making assertions about nature that are totally untrue and unprovable. For instance, I'm including in the references for this talk a little image of David Deutsch. He's a Jewish particle physicist, a Jewish theoretical physicist, dares to call himself Deutsch, which means German. And there's a quotation beside his picture, which says, quote, "Quantum computation is a distinctively new way of harnessing nature. It will be the first technology that allows useful tasks to be performed in collaboration between parallel universes," end quote. This is what David Deutsch says. But is it true? Is it true that quantum computation is a way of harnessing nature? Well, how is that possible? Do you know of any example? Can you conceive of any instance in which a D-wave quantum computer or the 17-mile-long Hadron Collider at CERN would be connected to any device that would produce any result, like a steam engine produces motion, like an internal combustion engine produces motion of a car, like other mechanical engines harness the force of nature, like a windmill, I mean a water mill attached to a granary so that the flow of the water turns the grinding device. Where is any example? What mastermind in this field today has ever presented one single example of harnessing the forces of nature with these sophisticated AI devices? Furthermore, he says that this technology allows useful tasks, well, such as what? What useful task? Name one useful task. To be performed in collaboration between albino Heffalumps. Now, you know what would happen. You know the brain power of one single albino Heffalump. That's impressive, yeah. But just imagine the power of combining the cerebral force of two albino Heffalumps in a single dynamo gizmo AI device. Imagine that. I guess you think that would be something pretty spectacular, right? Even on a cosmic scale, right? Reaching into the very fabric of space and time. Well, that dual albino Heffalump device is nothing compared to the quantum computers being peddled by David Deutsch and other individuals suffering, like himself, from the Jewish God complex. Collaboration between parallel universes? Prove it. Prove it. There are so many people today on the internet. There are an alarmingly large number of people in the alternative, so-called alternative zones of the internet, who are mindlessly repeating the claims coming from CERN and the D-Wave computer boys about what they can do, when in fact those demented nerds have yet to do anything or prove anything concrete whatsoever. Now, rather than continue further ranting about these matters, I'd like to tie up this talk in a gentle and elegant way, if I can. How would I do that? Well, I'd like to do it with two closing remarks. The first remark concerns the relationship between authentic mind, understood to be the mind of the planet itself, and the current breakdown of the human mind on the mass scale. It's no coincidence that access to the planetary mind would become a concern at the very moment when the mass of humanity plunges into full-blown schizophrenia. In fact, these two events come together in Kali Yuga. These two events, the breakdown of the human mind on the mass scale and the opportunity for some human minds to contact the mind of the planet, happen at the same time. And it could further be said that the way to get through the insanity now taking over the human race is to make contact with her mind. Her mind would then be your safeguard. It would be the failsafe of your own mind, and it would, communicating with her mind, would allow you to navigate through the insanity that befalls the human race as a whole. Now, as you savor this little proposition, if you find it tasty and worthy of savoring, consider this as well. What you have been known to call immortality was simply a matter of scale. So the planet and the life of the planet Earth is on a scale much larger than the life of the individual human animal. It's a difference of scale. It's the same life. Your life is the same as the life of the planet, but you experience it within an umwelt, or a limited scale. Something that is so many measures of scale beyond your individual life, as the life of the planet itself, is relatively immortal compared to your life. She is immortal compared to you, although she is not ultimately immortal in the cosmic framework, in the galactic framework from which she emerges. The commentary on Elon Musk and AI contains a reference to the difference between mind and brain. And the rather intelligent individual making that commentary points out that brain is something that is mortal and material. Your brain will die when you die. But that mind and brain are not the same. Mind does not die. Authentias nous, the mind on the planetary scale, is an immortal mind from the viewpoint of a human animal. But from that limited human perspective, the immortal mind is attainable. The immortal mind is accessible. Do you want to know what immortality is? so that you can have the assurance that you will survive death. Well, that's a complicated matter that needs to be discussed on its own terms. It needs to be given its own hour or so somewhere along the way. But just let me say this with complete certainty. If you attain contact with the planetary mind, which is immortal relative to your own, then you will have the mind of immortality that survives death before you die. The trick is to attain immortality before you die, not to know how you're going to have it afterwards or not have it. That's a completely erroneous approach. So don't think for a moment. Don't think for the extent of the wink of the eyelash of an albino huffalump about the immortality that you might enjoy after you die physically. Concentrate on the immortality you can have now. When you attain authentic mind by participation in her mind. Participation in her mind is the assurance of the immortality of your mind and not of your identity, but of your knowledge, of the knowledge you have acquired by living. That knowledge can survive you. That knowledge has a life of its own. That is your real immortality. Not the immortality of your personal identity. So as I said, this is a deep subject. Obviously, I'm raising some tricky questions by even bringing it up in this manner. Who knows, maybe it'll come up again in another sally. But for right now, to conclude this sally, I'll go to the second note, which I would like to be a simple and elegant note. And that note concerns the much-discussed subject of parallel universes. Now, I'll tell you right off the top, my friends, that there is something really wrong, really incompetent and ignorant in talking about parallel universes. Unless you can talk first about one parallel universe. How often do you hear talk about parallel universes? CERN has accessed parallel universes. There it is, David Deutsch, the Israeli mastermind of quantum computing, claims this. But is it true? Is he lying? Is he making it up? Does he know he's making it up? Does he know he's lying? Does he know there's an albino huffalump breathing down his neck? I seriously doubt it. Any talk of parallel universes is ludicrous unless you can first demonstrate actual mastery of two-way passage to one parallel universe. One. So, as you know, the subject of parallel universes, the topic, the theory, the fantasy, whatever you want to call it, often comes up in discussion of the Mandela effect. For instance, tell me if you've heard this before. Well, there's a theory related to quantum mechanics and to particulate physics also related to string theory and a number of other quantum relativistic propositions derived from the sleeping noises recorded by Schrödinger's cat when Schrödinger's cat was in the box. Or was it in the box? Anyway, there's a number of theories that say that when you get up in the morning and you have blueberry jam on your toast, there's another part of you that splits off and has oatmeal, and then there's another one that splits off and has a bagel with cream cheese. And as you go through your day, the single entity that you perceive yourself to be is splitting off into a number of parallel universes where there are an infinite number of alternative selves of you doing these different things. Now, do you believe that? Do you find that entertaining? Do you think that is provable? Do you think that string theory or quantum mechanics has proven that to be true? I propose to you that as a measure to preserve your own sanity, if your sanity is precious to you, that you do not for a moment, not for the blink of a heffalump's eyelash, bother your mind with these notions and these fantasies. I propose to you that you focus your heart and your mind on the prospect of one mirror world. One world that mirrors this world. Just one. And concentrate your mind on the notion that that mirror world coexists with your world. It is simultaneously and continually present in your time, in your timeline, and you have the opportunity to discover how to go there and how to come back from there, from that one mirror world. It's not a parallel universe. There is no parallel universe. There are mirror galaxies and mirror worlds. But there are no parallel universes. The term, the syntax is corrupt. Universe means one turning. One turning, universe. The universe, capital U, is the totality of everything that can exist. It comprises all galaxies and all worlds within galaxies. Therefore, the universe, capital U, comprises untold billions and billions of galaxies, some of which may be mirror galaxies to each other, some of which may contain planetary systems that are mirror worlds to other planetary systems. But the universe cannot have a parallel because by definition there is only one universe. Speak of parallel galaxies, if you will. On the record of Gnostic intel, the Andromeda Galaxy and the Milky Way Galaxy, in which the Earth and solar system are located, can roughly, more or less, be considered as parallel galaxies. But it's more accurate to say that within the Andromeda Galaxy, there is a planetary system containing an Earth-like body, and that Earth-like body within the galaxy of Andromeda is the mirror world to this Earth. So there is one mirror world. How many do you want? For fuck's sake! How many universes do you want? You can't even find your way across the room in this universe. And you want to be entertaining fantasies of parallel universes? It's nonsense. It's bad science fiction. And no sane and responsible person entertains these ludicrous and groundless notions. So understand, as I conclude, that I am not criticizing you. Those of you who listen to me, those of you who receive this notice of this talk and click on it, and that's not everybody in the list, by the way. So there's a selection process underway. But I'm not on your case, because I know that if you're listening to me, you're probably more or less sympathetic to these ideas. But you know what I'm getting at. This is the madness of our time. And cutting through that madness is the magic spell of the wisdom goddess herself. You know, spelling and witchcraft are the same thing. A magic spell is a way to spell. For instance, how do you spell the name in four letters for an icon or medallion that identifies a certain product? How do you spell the name for the icon that identifies, say, a Volkswagen automobile or a Ford automobile? Well, I believe you define them by the word logo. So there is the Volkswagen logo. And what is the plural of the word logo? Can you imagine how many times ordinary people use this plural term? Oh, the logos for different corporations, the logos for this or that. And they never, ever think of what the word L-O-G-O-S means in the singular form. Authentias nous, the planetary logos, the mind of Sophia, which is also your mind, as you experience it through a certain filtering mechanism or framing mechanism known as Mahamaya. So on that beautiful word, Mahamaya, I will conclude this sally and pick up with my outrageous and insupportable rantings and ravings at some time in the near future. Until then, stay clear, stay sober, and remember the Serenity Prayer in the version of the Calicas. O Goddess, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.